From TexasObserver.org, you're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. This is a half-hour radio news show in which we ask the Texas Observer's writers to take a break from writing and reporting to say things to you on the radio instead. The Observer's Fall Books issue will be out on stands shortly, so we'll be joined by writer Mary Helen Specht, who will talk to us about an unearthed novel by Woody Guthrie, and we'll also hear from Peter Voskamp discussing a slew of new books about the JFK assassination that have been released in anticipation of the 50th anniversary in November. But first things first, let's discuss this week's news. Joining me in the studio is Observer Associate Editor Forrest Wilder.
Hey, Jonathan.
How's it going, man?
It's going great.
And joining us by phone is staff writer Melissa Del Bosque. Melissa, how are you?
I'm doing good, thanks.
Awesome. So, Melissa, I hear you have a story for us about checkpoints.
Sure. I just came back from McAllen. I was there down in the Rio Grande Valley the last few days. And recently, just last week, the Department of Public Safety set up these roving checkpoints in Hidalgo County. And what they're doing, or what they say they're doing, is that they're checking people to make sure they have a valid driver's license and insurance. But what's happening is these checkpoints are creating chaos down there because residents are saying that the officers are asking about citizenship status, and that they've seen Border Patrol cars and trucks at the checkpoints, and that people are being deported. So as a result, people are locked up in their houses. They're not going to the stores. They're not taking their kids to school. I was talking to community organizers down there who said that it's like everybody's in lockdown. People are so afraid because many of the families there have mixed citizenship status, where the parents may not be documented, but their kids are U.S. Citizens.
Melissa, I have to say this sounds eerily similar to when SB 1070 passed in Arizona.
Yeah, it's that same kind of feeling. Back in 2006, El Paso tried this. You know, the sheriff, Samaniego, had set up these checkpoints, and he said, and they're allowed under state law to set up checkpoints to check for driver's license and insurance. But anything beyond that, they're not authorized to do that by law. And what was happening out there in El Paso was that residents were saying that, you know, there would be a Border Patrol truck there at the checkpoint, and that people were being profiled and that people were being deported. And there was a number of civil rights and racial profiling lawsuits filed against the sheriff's agency, and it became a big controversy out there, and he was forced to actually suspend the checkpoint. So this has been tried before, and it always creates this kind of panic, and the question is really whether it's a valuable law enforcement tool or
not. So DPS had a statement, the last thing that I saw from them, in which they were unequivocally saying that the checkpoints were purely for domestic reasons, that they were targeting a problem that I guess was significant in the valley around not having driver's licenses, expired registration, your usual kind of the run-of-the-mill DPS traffic violations. So is there evidence that that's not the case? That was the official line, at least coming from the top at DPS.
Sure, and that's what they also said. That's what the sheriff said over and over again in El Paso too. But what community organizations are doing now in the valley is they are collecting photos of Border Patrol cars parked next to DPS at the checkpoints, and a couple of Facebook pages have been started where people are warning each other where the checkpoints are set up, and they're uploading photographs of the Border Patrol trucks alongside the DPS officers. And so they've been collecting evidence and taking testimonies from people who say they've had family members deported. I mean, I've been kind of spent most of the day trying to track these folks down to see whether they actually were deported or you know, ask about their citizenship at the checkpoints, but I haven't been successful. A couple of numbers have been disconnected. People down there, and I'm talking about, for instance, Juanita Valdez Cox, who is the director of the nonprofit community organization Lupe, says, you know, we're still collecting data and we're just notifying people of their rights. We've contacted some attorneys, and so they're still very much in the process of figuring out what's going on.
Just quickly, Melissa, does DPS do this type of thing elsewhere in the state? I mean, I've certainly never experienced this in the places I've lived in Texas.
Yeah, neither have I.
No, and that's the thing, and that's what really upsets border communities, is to say, well, if this were to happen in Austin, people would be outraged. Because you're talking about lines of cars just waiting and waiting to get through these random checkpoints that are set up, and they don't let you know where they're going to be, of course. And it's really impacted local businesses. It's impacted the schools. And it's really having a big impact on families. So they feel like they're being unfairly targeted just because they live near the border.
And from that story, we go to some sort of special announcement out of Fort Worth. Forrest, can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, something big going down at Haltom City.
I heard it was important.
Specifically. So this is, I guess, a moment that's been a long time in the making. And within the next hour, I believe, Wendy Davis will be making her big announcement. And it's kind of funny because everybody pretty much knows that she's going to announce for governor. We've known that for a while, so there's been stories that have been leaking out, and just all the signs point to her announcing finally that she will be running for governor, of course, as a Democrat, against the likely Republican nominee, Greg Abbott.
Wendy's running for governor? No way.
Right. I know, shocker,
I don't
right?
believe it.
Shocker.
But, you know, now candidates, they make an announcement about an announcement. And that's
right.
What she did. And so in that interim, then it's actually kind of smart politically, because the media can't help but talk about it. And so you get a lot of free press and you build buzz and excitement. And then,
well, and on top of which, I've been seeing all kinds of people on Facebook and Twitter who are announcing that they're like gearing up to go to Fort Worth, you know, like
right.
packing their bags.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So
you mean they're moving there?
Well, maybe not.
So she's making her announcement at where she got her high school diploma, in a suburb of Fort Worth, and of course that's you know, near her Senate district that she's represented. So big news, and it's the official start to what I think is going to be, I suppose we always say this, but it's going to be a very interesting and exciting and probably much more competitive gubernatorial race than we've seen in Texas in a long time. I think that it's
finally,
and I think it's I think it's safe to say that Wendy Davis is a much better candidate in most respects than the last three or four Democratic candidates that we've seen. She certainly has a lot more momentum and excitement, and is a more interesting candidate. No offense to the previous folks. She still faces, an extraordinarily uphill battle, mostly through no fault of her own. The Democrats have lost 101 of the last 101 statewide races.
It's just painful to hear.
Yeah, and you know, this is still a Republican state, at least when it comes to electoral outcomes. Despite all the national attention and buzz around, is Texas turning blue? The Democrats, any candidate, no matter how good, has a lot of structural problems compared to the Republicans. The Democratic Party has been in disarray for many years. She's going to have a tough time raising the kind of money that Greg Abbott has already raised, $21 million the last time we saw his campaign finance filings. There's talk that he could raise $40 to $50 million.
Wow, that's a lot
of
money.
And the electorate has just been a Republican electorate, primarily because, you know, one of the main reasons why is turnout among Democratic constituencies, Democratic-leaning constituencies like Latinos, has been very low. So she's got a tough race, but it's going to be a competitive one, at least compared to the last few.
What do you anticipate being different this time around, though? I mean, and it's one thing to say these things, and like they're very obvious based on past experience, but like how is she set up to do things differently?
Well, I think she comes into this, first of all, and this is a little intangible and subjective, but I think that it's palpable. She comes into this as a celebrity, you know, for better or for worse. She comes into this as somebody who has fired up and energized a lot of people in the Democratic base and otherwise that have been sort of depressed for a long time. Also, there are some things happening on the ground in Texas that we haven't seen in a long time, actual kind of grassroots organizing and voter registration and turnout operations like Battleground Texas, which is run by Obama campaign veterans. So there are pieces that are coming together that are going to give her a boost, but it's a big gap to close. I mean, let's not underestimate that.
Cool. Well, guys, thanks for sharing that news with us.
Sure.
Joining us now is Mary Helen Specht, who recently wrote a piece about Woody Guthrie for our fall books issue. She is a creative writing teacher at St. Edward's University, and her works have appeared in such publications as The New York Times, which is a publication I've heard of.
Yeah,
of course,
me too.
You heard
too.
Of it? Yeah. So give us a little rundown on this piece about Woody Guthrie. What's going on here?
Well, last spring, Johnny Depp's publishing imprint.
I already love this story.
Yeah, who knew Johnny Depp had a publishing imprint?
Nice.
Published the long-lost novel of Woody Guthrie called House of Earth. And I'd been following this story since news broke that this manuscript had been found. Rice professor Douglas Brinkley was doing a piece on Bob Dylan and discovered this manuscript in the papers of a filmmaker named Irving Lerner. And even his biographers didn't know this existed. But what's also really interesting about this novel is that it's set in Texas, in the Panhandle, outside of Pampa. And most people don't think of Texas and Woody Guthrie. They think of Oklahoma, because he was born and raised.
Because he's from Oklahoma.
Yeah, in Okemah. Right. But when he was 17, he left Oklahoma, moved to Pampa, and lived in the Panhandle for 8 years. And it's actually in Pampa where he first discovered guitar. He was a soda jerk at a Harris drugstore in downtown Pampa, found a guitar in the back room, started his first band, the Corncob Trio, married his first wife. Very formative time period for Guthrie that a lot of people forget about. And then this novel that's been discovered is set in this area, in this time period during the Depression. So I was talking to Brad Tyer, managing editor, The Observer, and we thought it would be really cool to do a piece not just on the novel, not just on what it says about Guthrie, but also on what it says about Texas. So my father, who is a music historian, kind of ex-librarian, and I drove up to Pampa together to kind of see the downtown, see Harris Drug, see this group of people called the Woody Guthrie Folk Music Center, and also kind of learn about how Pampa has been very reluctant to claim Woody Guthrie, which is also kind of another interesting part of this story.
Actually, I found that by far the most interesting part. It was just really interesting to me that here's this town that could, right, you know, sort of at least cash in on the Woody Guthrie name, and they're just not doing it. What's up with that?
Well, and it seems to go way back. In the biography, in Joe Klein's biography of Woody Guthrie, it talks about how he would come back through town occasionally, you know, like local son made big. But even then, he was starting to become an outcast there. They thought he was a leftist rabble-rouser, and there was rumors that he was handing out communist pamphlets, and they didn't feel like he reflected their values. But what's crazy is that 50 years later, it's not much has changed in that sense. Thelma Bray is the woman who kind of heads up the Woody Guthrie Folk Music Center. And when she brought this idea to the Chamber of Commerce in 1992, two people stood up and said, Woody Guthrie is a communist and an anarchist, and he doesn't reflect our values. And so they've really kind of struggled to memorialize him in a way that the town will accept. So, yeah, it's very interesting.
I think if I were in Pampa, I would do everything I could to advertise the fact that Woody Guthrie had lived there, because I mean, they need all the help they can get, right?
Yes. So,
well, and they do have there. Obviously, there's some institutions in town that are already trying to do this. It's just like overall, but they're getting pushback. Like they tried to name a section, not even a street, a section of a street,
two blocks,
right? And they couldn't do that.
Well, they were eventually allowed to put up the signs as long as they, quote, didn't make a big deal out of it. They weren't, like, allowed to have any kind of unveiling or promotion for it.
Right.
So.
Now, Woody Guthrie's dad, he owned a, was it a, like a, like a flop house? Or what was it that he ran?
You don't see a lot of those these days.
Is that part of the bitterness, maybe?
Well, there is a little bit of the kind of darker underbelly side. Because when he arrived, it was 1929. His father ran this flop house with had all kinds of interesting customers. And Woody Guthrie was working, as I said, as a soda jerk. But he was also, of course, under the counter selling, quote-unquote, Jamaican Jake, which was, you know, some alcohol.
Moonshine kind of stuff.
Yeah, moonshine type stuff. So, and Guthrie refers to the town at the time as wilder than a woodchuck.
That's pretty wild.
Yeah, I guess. I guess that's pretty wild.
We can assume.
Yeah. So, and of course, a few years after he was there, the Depression did kind of end up hitting Pampa and things changed. But I think it was a bit of a wild place, and he does represent a little bit of that for Pampans too, I think.
So I want to go back a second. Doug Brinkley found the manuscript for this novel in a archive somewhere, right?
Or right.
Was it a private collection?
Well, it was in the papers of a filmmaker. And so apparently Guthrie had sent the manuscript to this filmmaker, Irving Lerner, in California, hoping that this guy would make it into a film,
okay,
which never happened.
Now, Guthrie was, of course, famously prolific when it came to writing songs. That's how Billy Bragg and Wilco were able to cut so many albums out of just lyrics, essentially. But how does somebody so well-known as Woody Guthrie write a novel, considering he only wrote, I believe, one other, Not Bound for Glory, right, mm-hmm. and have it lost to history like that?
Well, and yet, after Bound for Glory, he actually had a two-book deal. And so they were expecting him to come up with a second book. But from what we know, he tried lots of different books. So we knew there was lots of partial manuscripts. But yeah, it was a secret that he'd actually completed one and pretty polished it, you know, extensively. And what's also interesting is that it's pretty racy. A lot of parts of the novel, there's like long sex scenes that go into lots of details, which might be another reason that the Guthrie didn't feel like it was going to be publishable in his day, at least in the form in which he wrote it. That's what some people believe. But
so in your essay, you kind of talk about the contemporary, as in present day, reaction to the novel. And I think Larry McMurtry didn't particularly care for it. Doug Brinkley thought that it had some nice things to say about it. In your view, what are the strengths and I guess weaknesses of the book? Having, I assume, read it.
Yes.
Ooh.
Thank gosh.
Yeah.
Well, it's an interesting book. Some people have compared it to Steinbeck in its tone. A lot of it is political. It's about this couple, Tyke and Ella Mae Hamlin, who are farmers. First they're renting, and then they're sharecropping, and they're having a very hard time. So there's a lot of kind of political things in terms of how the working people are kind of kept down by the banks and by big ag and that sort of thing. But it's also this kind of beautiful domestic story. And that's the part that I kind of came alive for me when I was reading it, the relationship between these two people, and as well as the descriptions of the land. That's the part that I thought was really beautiful, the way he describes this part of the panhandle, which is called the Cap Rock, and he calls it the gumbo mud, which I really like. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure it's going to transform his legacy or ever kind of really be able to compare to his songs, but I do think it's really interesting what it says about Texas.
So what was his obsession with adobe homes? That was something that kind of, and rereading your piece, that was kind of like, huh? He thought that adobe homes could be a revolutionary tool.
Yes, and he absolutely did believe that. We actually know from his letters from the time period that Guthrie became obsessed with adobe homes. He wrote these long letters to people about how if only everybody built adobe homes, first of all, they wouldn't have to buy wood from the, you know, big wood companies, and dirt is free and it's insulated and it's warm in the winter and cool in the summer. And he felt like this would kind of transform working people's lives. And so he kind of gives this idea to his main character, who actually sends off for a pamphlet that did exist where the government would try to teach you how to build adobe homes. But like a lot of things, Woody Guthrie liked the idea more than, you know, maybe the actual physical labor of it. And so I don't think he had a lot of success himself building adobe homes, but he never really kind of gave up that idea, obviously, because the novel isn't written to the 40s. So we know he kept this idea till pretty late, that it would revolutionize the working class.
Probably wouldn't work too good in, say, like, I don't know, Houston, where it's really humid. Maybe Albuquerque
soggy
would be perfect for that.
It also sounds like a bit more than just like a weekend project. I mean, that's pretty invested.
Yeah, I think it takes some skill, mm-hmm. definitely.
Well, then it's not for me. Forrest, are you going to do one?
You know, I might make it a miniature. Maybe I'll try that first.
There you go.
Or write a song about it, even better.
Even better. Well, Mary, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Joining me now is Peter Voskamp, who's a freelance writer based in Washington, D.C., and a regular contributor to JFKFacts.org. Mr. Voskamp, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you.
So, Mr. Voskamp recently wrote a piece for our fall books issue about a slew of JFK assassination books that are coming out in anticipation of the 50th anniversary of JFK's assassination on November 22nd. Can you give us a brief rundown on this piece?
Yeah, we should probably say that they are coming out to coincide with the assassination. They're not all necessarily about the assassination. There's a few books like Robert Dalek's Camelot's Court and Thurston Clark's JFK's Last 100 Days that are sort of overviews of the administration. And in the case of Thurston Clark's book, it's about his last 100 days. And Clark argues that he was after the death of his infant son, Patrick, who was born prematurely, that JFK turned over a new leaf in the last part of his administration, and he was going to pursue civil rights with more vigor, and he was likely going to pull out of Vietnam, and he was even going to slow down on his womanizing.
So these really cover a lot of different topics, including one of the things I was very interested about is the question: would the assassination have happened if it wasn't in Texas?
Well, that's University of Texas journalism professor Bill Minutaglio and joined by Stephen Davis have written a book called Dallas 1963.
Yeah, we know Mr. Minutaglio quite well. He's a regular contributor to our magazine.
Right, he's a fantastic writer, and he and Mr. Davis know Texas very well, and they pointed out that in all the dozens and dozens and probably hundreds of books written about the assassination, very few concentrate on the locale itself, Dallas. And what they do in this book is they kind of look at the seamy underbelly of Dallas at the time in terms of there's a lot of right-wing zealotry at the time, and that combined with a lot of money in terms of Howard Hunt and some of the other oil, really conservative right-wing oil men that were there, combined with Edwin Walker, who was the deposed Army general that the JFK deposed because he was a pro-segregationist, and then there was Reverend W.A. Criswell, who was also based in Dallas, who his flock was the largest, Baptist church in the world, and he was very vehemently against JFK.
Right.
And so was the publisher of the Dallas Morning News, Mr. Dealey, who actually even confronted JFK at a White House meeting, saying that America needed a man on a horse, not someone riding Caroline's tricycle. So
wow.
What the authors are showing or talking about is they're just painting the scene of what Kennedy was coming into, and they don't necessarily say that Dallas, it was that Dallas conspired to do it, but they suggest that maybe there was an atmosphere there that might have added to the assassin's mindset. They point out stuff like how Adlai Stevenson had been shouted down and hit with picket signs when he visited Dallas, just before JFK went. And also an event that not many people knew about, I didn't really know about it, was that when LBJ and Lady Bird went to Dallas just before the 1960 election, they were mobbed by a bunch of right-wingers.
Oh, really?
Who were, hitting them with signs and spitting at Lady Bird, saying that, by becoming part of the Kennedy ticket, he was surrendering to socialists. So that was what was going on in Dallas at the time. At the same time, the authors try to point out that, there's some counterweight to this. There were people like Stanley Marcus, who started Neiman Marcus, who, wanted he likes JFK, and he wanted to, he was the the yin to the yang of Dallas. They're, you know, up and coming, more liberal-minded people, and also the Reverend Rhett James, who brought Martin Luther King to Dallas.
You draw a lot of parallels from this time and that political climate to like the political climate of the current day. In fact, one of the things you said is it's hard to read Dallas 1963, which is the book we're discussing, without seeing parallels to today's corrosive national politics, in which an obstreperous right wing reacts angrily to any proposal by a largely centrist Democratic president. I mean, how do you see that playing out today when, you know, there were shots fired at the Capitol?
Yeah, I know. It's crazy. We're still trying to figure out what happened with that today. But, I mean, well, you know, we've got Senator Cruz has brought us to where we are today. As you know, as we speak, the government is shut down, and largely because Senator Cruz arguably led the call to that. And there's even something I just saw recently. One of the Texas representatives confronted one of the Park Service people at one of the World War II memorial, you know, screaming at her about, how dare you stand in the way of veterans, where it was obviously kind of a photo op, I think. But anyway, point is, yeah, the Texans are still very much in the conservative camp, even, you know, 50 years later.
So, you know, one of the things that's really fascinating to me is somebody who was not around for the JFK presidency, was born much later, is how his presidency and assassinations still have such a grip on the American imagination. I think, you know, proof positive of that is just the number of titles that, yeah, it's pegged to a 50th anniversary, but still there's such an interest in this presidency and in particular the assassination. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is? What is it about JFK and that event that are still so important, and there's still so much to be discussed, apparently?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's so many dynamics and layers involved in this. I mean, there's first just they were a romantic couple. They were a very attractive couple, which, you know, Marilyn Monroe posters and books still sell, so Kennedy and Jackie right. books still sell. His death is arguably still it's the whodunit of the whodunits. So there's that attraction. I think some people have argued that to discuss the Kennedy assassination is to kind of discuss how you feel about America itself, because if you're comfortable with the official explanation for what happened, then that might show that you're comfortable with the authorities and just generally the institutions, and that there was no skullduggery involved, and America is still what it always has claimed to be and tried to be and tried to live up to be. And then there's those on the other side who think that perhaps 1963 marked turn to a darker side where things might have been hidden from the public, and the rise in the military-industrial complex, which JFK's predecessor Ike warned against in his outgoing speech. Interestingly, if you look at a poll of people's trust in government, it started declining right after the Warren Commission report came out in 1964 and has never really regained the heights that it had before the Kennedy assassination. So, people are wringing their hands 50 years later because I don't feel like a lot of people feel like there's been closure about it, you know?
Right.
Mr. Voskamp, thank you very much for being on the show.
Sure. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you.
Well, unfortunately, we've reached the end of our show, but there are other episodes of Observer Radio available at texasobserver.org. And before we leave, I'd like to thank Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our intro and outro music. And also, I'd like to thank you for listening. We'll talk at you next time on Observer Radio.